Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I am hopping mad and I want something in the middle.
Aha! Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Little pierce my foot on the spike.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical, awesome, mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Edmonds is a total wazzard of a guy.
Yes, 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 and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
This is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net. Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Hello, friends, and welcome again to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Anyone who doesn't learn from the past is doomed to repeat it, from people who vote Labour to men that dye their own hair.
Nick Holder.
I've got AIDS!
And Tom Stab.
We've lost him. We've already lost him.
It's a quality show, I can assure you of that.
Yes, so we're back again discussing once again that quality show vis-a-vis the following, It's Stratagem. A couple of housekeeping notes at the top of the episode. Obviously, Stratagem is now streaming on Amazon Prime. So if you're listening to this, I would go back and watch that first. But otherwise, this is going to be spoiler heavy. And also, today's episode is not going to go through Stratagem in painstaking detail. We already did that, having seen it live at the O2. But we are going to revisit it and look at things we might have missed, whether our opinions have changed, and other tidbits that we've picked up along the way. If you've ever watched a crime drama where somebody's run over and then they reverse over them to make sure that the deed is done, it's very much in a similar vein to that.
So we're reversing over a corpse this week.
I mean, according to the reviews, yes, we sort
stop,
of are.
Stop, he's already dead, etc.
So right at the top of the show, oh well, those of you that listened to our Stratagem episode will know that three quarters of us saw it live at the O2. One of us selfishly took time out to procreate, but he's back now.
He wasn't
with
shacking.
His opinion.
Hang on, I wasn't. I mean, that bit had happened 9 months previously. Anyway, we don't need to get bogged down in all that.
No.
That's fine.
So, Tom Dark, having joined us in the Stratagem wagon, what did you make of it?
All right, well, look, I think probably the best way to do this, if I'll kind of go through the notes I've made of the good bits, the particularly bad bits, and anything else of note, and I think, you know, chip in with what you guys think in terms of the comparison of having now seen it live and seen it on streaming.
Fine to join in.
Guys, I'm going to be honest, and I don't want to spoil too much of my overall review, but it's not going to be good. Well, at the opening, obviously, you've got a pre-filmed VT sequence, which I assume wasn't at the on the screens at the O2 or anything, I'm assuming there.
You would assume correctly, yeah. This wasn't shown in the arena at all. It didn't feature in the show. When I clicked play on Amazon Prime, which, you know, obviously we all did, this is the first thing that we saw and it was brand new. So I was like, oh, actually, I'm quite... excited, engaged, like there was some new partridge to consume. Now, obviously, this was done on the same shoot day or shoot session as the Oasthouse Series 2 promo content, because Alan is dressed the same, sort of in his white sort of stylish garb, Arabian scarf sort of thing, and a beard as well. And he says that he's got the beard because he's just returned from a fact-finding mission on different cultures and belief systems.
Yeah, which is surely teeing up the next TV project, and possibly the reason back in the day Steve didn't want his driving ban, is that this sort of travelogue idea. I wonder if this is them subtly sowing the seed for something that is going to become reality. And I also wondered, if this does become reality, I wonder if it'll end up on Amazon or the BBC.
Well, that was my thought, that probably it would be Amazon if they're doing promo time on his Audible/Amazon time. And obviously this is kind of quite speculative as a promo in terms of what that will look like. I would assume that the next iteration of Alan could be on Amazon, especially as this promo is on, Stratagem is on Amazon and the Audible relationship. So who knows? He's been on all the platforms now.
What we're saying is he's drenched in Amazon cash.
Until he's squelchy.
I also thought it was interesting that the different cultures and belief systems, he's travelled around to discover them, but he's mainly gone to tax havens and countries that end in Stan, causing him to very nearly slip up when he's pronouncing Pakistan as well.
I mean, it's interesting, actually, because so we've got, I mean, how long is that bit? Like a minute, not even 2 minutes, probably. And then we've got the handful of photos from that shoot day that we used around Oasthouse as well. I wonder if there's anything else from this day or this session that is yet to be seen, because there hasn't been very much out there from it. If you compare the amount of photos that were available around Oasthouse Series 1, and also things like, yeah, why has he got a beard when he doesn't have a beard in the Stratagem live show? Like all those sort of things, you go, there are specific choices made there, and does it actually mean any more? Does it hold any more significance? Or it was literally like, that's just what they're going to do. It just seems weird, because I think, you know, he's in some very specific locations, but they haven't made much of it. So whether there is more, and whether there's, you know, whether that was a preliminary day filming for whatever the next project is, that'd be interesting to see if we do see more from that setup. But yeah, I thought this opening bit, I thought this boded quite well to begin with.
There's some nice notable bits in here as well. Obviously, as Tom Stubbs done in the intro, he says it's a quality show. I can assure you of that directly after telling us it's yet to be written. Yeah. So that's a nice touch. And he obviously is... Steve obviously knows the recording at the O2, but Alan says, I don't know the venue, don't know the name. Just hope it's not the O2. It's just a massive tent. Should have been taken down 20 years ago.
And obviously, the writers are very much poking fun at themselves here, because I think famously, we've talked about this before, that, you know, they essentially, it feels like they put the Stratagem tour on sale without knowing what it was going to be. So that's very much what they're referencing within this this VT, because obviously by the time this VT was filmed, Stratagem did exist, well, at least to some degree of writing, at the very least. So yeah, should we get into the thick of the actual O2 show in that case, coming up next? Yeah, well, let's dive into the opening song. I thought the opening song was pretty awful and not very funny. The jokes about, particularly the latter part, so it's kind of like a medley he opens with, isn't it? Built This City, Welcome to the Show, Where's Alan Partridge? And there's also like a rap segment. I particularly thought the jokes about rap feel a bit like they should be left in the 90s. You know, Alan doing What's Up G, Some Homie's Been Dissing My Bitch back in like 1998 was funny when I was 16, but now it just feels a bit like, have we not moved on? Like, hip-hop as a source of comedy feels a bit off the mark. And also, half of the rap bit was him reading an Argos listing of a watch. I also made a note that in this kind of song intro, the echo around the O2 was audibly noticeable, which made me feel a bit sad, because it sounded so empty. And I did think, surely, you know, with other comedy shows at the OT, you must be able to do something about the echo. And actually, I did find some Michael McIntyre OT footage, and the echo is there, but there's also pretty much constant laughter throughout, so you can't detect it as much. So maybe that's the difference there.
A couple of things just from rewatching this on the intro. I wish they'd done more with the Dr. Alan Gordon Partridge thing. I wish that had been like referenced later on in the show, or maybe it'll come in a future project, because that does kind of grab you by the jaffers when that intro happens. And then the other thing was that I was kind of nervous about how this show would go, and nervous on rewatching it when I was rewatching it, where the opening is basically four songs in a row. The We Built This City parody, Welcome to the Show, the Hamilton parody, the rap, as Tom sort of described. But also, I do wonder if the Hamilton parody kind of went over a lot of people's heads and they didn't really understand that either. It was kind of a bit of an odd choice, maybe. I don't know. But Tom, you haven't seen Hamilton. Nick, you have?
No, I've seen Hamilton on Disney Plus or whatever, and right. Do you know what? I didn't even clock that was supposed to be a Hamilton parody.
Yeah, it wouldn't have occurred to me.
That tells you something.
It's one of those things I think has fallen through the gaps, in that they thought, you know, Hamilton is a huge thing. A lot of people have seen it. It's a safe route for parody, but it wasn't specific enough to Hamilton for people to go, that's a Hamilton parody. I think a lot of people probably just thought, oh, it's like a weird generic kind of rap parody without really making that connection.
Well, did you pick up on that at the time, Tom? Because you're a big Hamilton fan.
Yeah, I did. Okay.
One other thing, not to skip ahead too much, but just when we're talking about, you know, him pretending to be, you know, a rap artist and that belonging in the 90s, I think you see that again in the finale, right at the very end, when there's basically a load of stuff around proportional representation and lots of like jokes about Lib Dems getting in, which to me felt like jokes that are, you know, safely a decade old. It's obviously funny he's doing it at the same time as trying to perform a track from Grease and Lift a Woman in the Air, but the joke itself felt like it was sort of from a bit of a bygone era.
I think we'll perhaps discuss that in a bit more length towards the end, but I think you're right about the Lib Dem reference being dated, but I did quite like the switch in tone for the character at that point. But anyway, that's towards the end, so we'll come back to that, I think. Should we move on to... Basically, Alan starts to present stratagem, new ways of thinking in a post-COVID world. So this opens with essentially a kind of Apple iPod advert ripoff. I just thought, yeah, it works in terms of like, you know what he's doing, but isn't that joke about 15 years too late?
Well, what I will say to the defence of that is that the music is different on the streamed version than what it was in the arena. And I think every time that joke was used, that visual joke was used, it did get quite a good reaction from the audience. There were quite a lot of laughs, and it did. So the original music was a Sean Paul song, and I guess, as we know from later on in the show, clearing rights and it's quite an expensive business, so maybe they weren't able to secure Sean Paul, and I just assumed that they'd used some like stock audio, but apparently it is an actual song. It's called Do Goo Man or Do Go Man or something like that, and it's by Kelton Wade and Jason Leggett, and it has 135,000 streams on Spotify, so probably a lot cheaper than Sean Paul.
So do you think, did that gag work in the room because just the different music choice made it funny?
I think so, yeah. I think it did get a laugh pretty much every single time.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure when we did the initial feedback on it, I remember saying that was one of the funnier things in the show. I found it funny, and I think music probably plays a part of it. And yeah, it is dated, but I think that's sort of the point, that it's a reference point that's so old, but he's used it in a kind of a way that's supposed to be kind of cool. And it's like, it's 15 years old. An iPod isn't even a thing anymore.
Yeah, this is the tricky thing, isn't it? Is that a lot of these things, the kind of the Nick Clegg reference, the rap parody, the iPod like stuff, you could argue that in real life, that's a very dated reference. You could also argue it's the sort of dated reference that Alan would think was current, but
yes.
I'm still not sure that's enough to drag it into the realm of being, you know, worth putting in this show. It's a tricky one. I don't think that gives the writers a pass, personally.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was thinking about that a lot. A lot of the stuff which I think didn't really work or land for that well, I think, yeah, there's always a conceit where you can go, yes, but Alan would think this or Alan would do that. But I'm just, you know, when you're doing a big show like this, I just think it's got to be tighter than that. You don't have to sit there and twist ways to make it make sense, basically.
I think one thing that you can really notice at the beginning of the show versus the end of the show is that I think this section, basically for the first maybe 15 minutes, 15, 20 minutes, let's be generous and say 20 minutes, a lot of the jokes do land with the audience, and there is quite a lot of loud laughing and appreciation for the get. Like the sponsor joke lands, I think, the first time it's used, and it was funny in the room. And also the swears rolling over to Glasgow also gets quite a big laugh. And that was that. I mean, I think, like, in the defence of this show, I think the first 20, 25 minutes until he gets it, I've got a note as to when it actually tips over into starting to go downhill. I think the opening section of this, basically up until the travel back through time, is solid, if not actually good.
I think I'd broadly agree with that. I mean, I did really enjoy the Better 365 and P&O Ferries. P&O Ferries is a sponsor, great gag. And just like, you know, that, just, you know, just that in itself works. And I thought the lose a house or win a bigger one was quite a good line. So that's all right. But, you know, it's just other things going on in the mix here when you go, yeah, you're making jokes about how white and male and middle-aged audience is. And it's like, it's just all a bit too on the nose, because then you've got some of the opening stratagem gambits are about helping empowering a woman and helping a black man feel empowered, which, or just, I don't know, that all felt a little bit icky and a bit too on the nose, maybe. Also, the fact you can see quite a few empty seats, some people in the audience looking a bit confused and not necessarily loving it, and this is all within like the first, like, 13 minutes.
Oh, I didn't spot the empty seats when I was...
I didn't see that.
It's not like there's a whole bank of empty seats, but I think just knowing, as I did watching this, that it wasn't fully sold out, and that, particularly hearing from you guys and other people that went, that there were visibly lots of empty seats.
Also, the other thing, this may not be from one show. This might be they recorded all of the O2s and it's sort of spliced together. There's different nights, because quite often bands and even comedians do that. They film multiple nights and then they can pick the best sections and kind of splice them together.
Yeah, I can't remember. I'm sure we had some intel about them recording one of the nights, but I don't know whether it was multiple. And then just to finish this bit before we get onto the kind of time travel letter from the past section, to be honest, and it was a bit route one, but my first actual laugh was about the fake vagina nearly missed my flight gag. I mean, it was obvious where it was going, but it was a bit of a release of, like, the punchline landed, and I think that worked well with the crowd as well. But then you have this bit when Alan goes out into the crowd, like using the phone as a camera, and like one of the big punch, or like the big punchline to that was like, the man has a face that says Classic FM. I was like, that was rubbish. Like, it just didn't go anywhere.
It's not
and
even a,
the
yeah,
payoff
it's not
was
really a joke.
Rubbish. I did like the when you get the iPod silhouette dance returned and you've got him grabbing his knee. That did make me laugh. Because again, that's like, you could quite easily miss that as well. And I thought it was interesting. There are a few, like, getting Lynn on the screen, going in the biscuit cupboard. So a couple of callbacks to Knowing Me, Knowing You All, I thought. So Lynn is, I think, looking for boasters. And also he talks about his home being vulnerable to burglary. When we know that is basically he's been a victim of that because people have known he's been on live TV. So I thought, you know, there's some nice callbacks to Partridge in the 90s there. But by this point we're approaching 23 minutes in and I'm not loving it, I've got to be honest.
In terms of crowd reaction as well, I mean, there were a couple of really good sort of roars, but it felt to me in the room that the reaction wasn't very strong. It was murmured laughter rather than roaring laughter. I feel like those of us that have worked in the music industry know that often a band will record a live album and then it will get touched up and you'll add in crowd reaction. And, you know, like when you go and see panel shows being recorded, they get you to do a big cheer at the start, which they can pipe in to, you know, when moments in the actual show don't really land. I felt like this could have used some of that. Like, they should have taken some big crowd reactions and peppered them throughout the show, because I feel like if you weren't at the show and you were watching this, I don't think you'd feel like you were you know, witnessing a show that the people there were loving. I think you think about how long he's been away from the live arena. He bursts out at the start of the show and shouts "aha," and the crowd are not going crazy. Like, they're just sort of, you know, great, it started. Not like I've been waiting for this moment for 10 years or whatever, you know. I felt like the crowd response was quite muted, and that's because the show's not that good.
So and they should have piped in some of the laughter from Michael McIntyre at the
OT. I think they could have given a better impression to the people who were watching it for the first time at home that this was a home run by just amping up some of that crowd noise.
If we think about when these three live shows have happened that Steve's done, the first one was 97, am I right?
No, 92 or 94. I can't remember off the top of my head.
So okay, so it's arguably when he's won BAFTAs, he's presented at the Brit Awards. Arguably, this is the hottest thing in comedy right now. So the crowd are going to be like really super amped and pumped for it. Then you've got other less successful characters where there hadn't been any Alan for a long, long time. And so people would have been excited for what was essentially a comeback. And this time, pun intended, this time we've had loads of Partridge in the since 2013, last 10 years, let's say, last 10, 12 years. So there is a bit of a less of a kind of anticipation for this, probably reflected in ticket sales. Less anticipation for Alan, so maybe the crowd is just going to be a little bit more muted because we have had such an influx of new Alan over the last 10 to 12 years.
Just to go back to the Lynn section, because I know we're talking about her being in, I really noticed rewatching this on streaming how badly her side of the dialogue and Alan's side of the dialogue line up. It really feels like he finishes his line and then somewhere somebody presses a button and then a second later you hear Lynn's line. It doesn't feel like they're having a fluid conversation. And like, they could have got that right, because later when he's doing the piece with Martin Brennan, that works a lot better and that feels like a real conversation. Mm. But this to me felt very much like Steve's in the room and Felicity is on tape. You know, it didn't feel like it was a real conversation happening in real time. And I think that's a real shame.
Should we move on to Letter from the Past?
If we have to.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think this bit starts about, this is about 23 minutes in here. I mean, I definitely agree with what Stab's saying. This is where it really starts to take a dive. And remember, I'm saying I've already not been loving it anyway. I didn't even like the opening song, and I think perhaps others have enjoyed that a bit more. I mean, I liked the setup with this when he's talking about things like living with children who love you dearly. That's quite a good little gag. Everybody that knows the character well knows that's not the case, knows that. But then just going back to school, like, and having the girl playing him, I just didn't think anything of this was very funny. I didn't feel like there was much of a payoff. And then to go to Norwich in 2065, I mean, I hated this bit, to be honest with you. One thing I did spot, though, and whether you guys would have noticed this in the live show, you know when, like, you've got the time machine effect on the screen, you've got the newspapers going past, and there are a few gags about Prince Andrew. So you've got Arise, King Andrew, and some other stuff.
Right.
So I thought a bit of fun with subtle gags like that, but again, not enough to carry it. And I also thought one of the biggest laugh reactions of the night, and probably in the show so far, aside from Lynn at this point, is when he says they pedestrianised it all. So, you know, the big laughs
like
are coming.
I did quite like that.
Yeah, I mean, and it wasn't bad, but I think it's a shame that the biggest gags we're getting are all about recognition of stuff from 1997.
Yeah,
I feel like, you know, and that's an inherent problem with doing a show at the O2 Arena.
Yeah.
You're going to have people that have only watched I'm Alan Partridge.
Yeah, I mean, there was one point that I picked up on the second watching of it on streaming, was that they cut to the crowd and there are maybe three people visibly wearing Linton Travel Tavern t-shirts or jumpers or something like that. So it's the, and I think we spoke about this in the first episode on this, is that when you get to arena level comedy, it is very, this is a difficult show for than to write, basically, because they don't 100% know whether to
agreed.
Like it is a challenge, but I think it is, and I guess this is a wider point of about arena comedy, is that it is super broad, and that our preference would be to watch this in a much smaller venue and keep it sort of what's the best word to just make it less broad and just make it more up to date with what make it more up to date with what Alan's been up to recently for people who are super fans and not super fans, but you know what I mean. It's a real challenge, and I think they were stuck between a rock and a hard place, and I don't think they really worked out what they wanted the show to be and who they wanted it to be for.
I 100% agree, and I think it's really apparent what kind of scattergun approach they've had. And I think the one thing I was impressed by watching this back is that I think the total number of gags across the whole show is much higher than I remember from seeing it live, but it's so badly paced, and some of them are so broad and some of them are so niche, they feel like they're parts of a separate show. And I think you have long sections like the time travel where there's barely anything, and then you've got bits where it's going, you know, some of the songs and things, it's going past so fast that they're not giving it enough time to land each time as well. So it just feels a bit all over the shop.
It's almost a bit like they shouldn't have put an arena tour on sale until they'd written it and figured out what it was going to be.
Yeah, it's the Bainham method, isn't it, basically? It's write it in the back of the car on the night.
Well, I mean, look, historically, this is what happens in the APU. Like, pretty much every bit of Partridge we know about, there's always been some kind of writing down to the wire, particularly from, I guess, from I'm Alan Partridge Series 2 onwards. But, I mean, I think particularly talking about things feeling like they're part of a different show, this time travel bit, particularly the time travel bit in the future,
yeah,
like, just what is this? Like, it is like some like fever dream, and not in any kind of good way. Just, yeah, I mean, look, to quote Simon Cowell in X Factor, crazy bad. Like, I honestly just, I was watching this in disbelief. Like,
so the worst bit for me, the bit where I completely lose all hope for this section, is when they go, oh, Alan, I haven't used that name for decades. My name is now 5. It's like, could you not have thought of a funnier punchline or gag for what Alan goes by now? Like, that felt really lazy. Rubbish. And just like no care or attention or thought had gone into that. 5. Come on, guys, we're better than this.
Yeah, totally.
I think another reason why I really hated this section is because it really took me out of...
And another thing.
I'm pulling my punches here. It just kind of took me out of, like, Alan world, out of the APU. Now, obviously, I know the whole thing. The conceit here within the Stratagem show is this is him talking about kind of the medium of theatre and how you can kind of go anywhere and do anything using theatre to illustrate that. But this was just so far removed from anything that kind of made sense or had any relation to, I don't know, just what we've seen Alan do in the past. Because, you know, you've had similar things with something like other less successful characters when he does the historical play, which I think we all agreed wasn't great. But that felt like, you know, one, that's Alan using theatre within a show. So that's a show within a show. So he's done that sort of thing before. But that made sense with the character. That was kind of tied up with things that we know the character has interests in. This kind of thing, because it's a bit like, okay, so is this an imagined theatrical vision of the future, or are we now supposed to go with the fictional conceit that Alan has now gone to the future? Like, the whole thing was just a mess. And I mean, also just things like, again, an Intel Pentium processor advert being the joke. I mean, I think the sonics of the joke worked, because again, it's basically the Whiskers advert joke again. But again, Intel Pentium processor, another gag that's about 15 years old. And maybe you can make the argument that in Alan's world, that's right, that he thinks this is an on-the-money topical reference, but it just was not good.
Two things on that, really. One is that I think the Pentium gag reminded me that, much like him finding, you know, one of the women in the show attractive, much like this sort of like vaudeville musical review style show, a lot of it is just lifted from, you know, the previous show. And I think I said this on the main Stratagem episode. It's just a bit of a case of, okay, what's 2023's version of these 5 gags that we've done in all of our stand-up shows? You know, this time let's make it Pentium, last time it's Whiskers, this time it's, you know, the girl that you know, the last time it was the other girl. You know, I just think that I'm surprised.
What's the medley this time? Was another one.
It's yeah, like exactly. Yeah, yeah. I'm surprised at the lack of inventiveness.
Yeah.
Given how inventive they are elsewhere. And I think the other thing for me is that I've said it before, I'll say it again, like a broken record, live is not Partridge's medium, I don't think. And I think part of it is because it's much easier. I enjoy Partridge much more when I believe that he's off somewhere, that I, you know, not in my world, I'm not in his world. He's off somewhere doing something and I will see the fruits of that labour at some point. When he's in front of me in an arena, I think it's much harder to marry the idea that he is headlining a 20,000 capacity arena with he is this sort of broken underdog that, you know, people don't like. And I think it's hard to reconcile those two ideas. And I haven't ever really enjoyed Partridge live, whereas I've frequently loved Partridge output elsewhere.
Yeah, I definitely would agree with the kind of repetition and them kind of treading ground that they've trod before. I mean, it felt like this could have come out in 96, basically, and you wouldn't have known. And it kind of feels like with COVID and Brexit and the world as it was and the Gibbons, that there was an opportunity to actually do something different and interesting. And the trailer sort of gave a promise of something that was quite interesting. But I think, as you just said, Adam, like, this is what, the third live show now, and they're all pretty disappointing, but it didn't feel like it had moved on. And this really could have come out in the late 90s and would have felt comfortable and as funny as it is in, you know, 2023 or 2022, and this is obviously live, but it's a shame that this hadn't progressed significantly, especially with the writing team, which have elevated the character to such a level.
You know what, that's such a good point in terms of, yeah, when they first put the trailer out, they were very much going down the route of it was going to be something about a divided country and bringing people together. So obviously kind of having a bit of a dig at Brexit divisions and stuff. And obviously that, I mean, was that ever even in an initial draft of the script? We'll never know. But it feels like maybe it wasn't and it was just a half-formed idea, which they never really got into a show level. Because also, I remember us talking about last year, there was a point, I think, probably around Oasthouse Series 2, there was conversation about, oh, Alan gets cancelled in real time in this show. And it's been like, well, what happened to that either? That also wasn't a thing. I felt like there have been so many kind of threads we've been given where you've kind of gone, oh, I could picture that and see how that could be good and how that could work. And particularly it ties in with something in this time or something in Oasthouse. And none of that has materialised. But I know the Gibbons have always got the fail-safe where they've kind of said, if fans can think of us doing it, we don't want to do it. But I mean, I don't think any fans would have written this show with good reason.
And it's that, like, I wonder if when they were going through the writing process, when they pitched Stratagem and then they were obviously developing the script, I wonder if there's any point where they said it out loud or just thought it, where they're like, this is basically, you know, Lilm, that Lessons in Life Management. Like, we have done this before. In most of, you know, Alan's live shows, that there's this kind of like transformational business thing, you know, that has been the through line of all of his shows. And so we're going to do that again, only this time there's nothing new or original about it and it's exactly the same. And they're like, yep, great.
That's lunch.
But but that's the thing. It's like, because yeah, you've got Lilm, you've got Forward Solutions, obviously Stratagem very clearly was deliberately a continuation of that type of life improvement idea. But yeah, if they'd have gone into it and made it a much more topical piece, which Alan's never really done before, it would have felt like a very different kind of piece. But they didn't do that. Again, this has just a kind of like this variety show feel to it that all of the other Coogan live shows have had.
I did enjoy the one gag in this section that I did enjoy was that about the Go Compare man being beaten to death in 2044.
Yeah, that is funny. That is good.
Should we move on very quickly to Jeanette Jackson before we get on to the next song? So Jeanette Jackson, played by Emma Siddy. I did quite like the line they talk about people from Wigan in tonight, and he says, what, with tickets? just the way he, that was as a response, I thought was quite good. And there's a knee-cracking gag here, which I thought was really well done. That was very funny. I think that got a big laugh, if I remember as well.
Yeah.
But then, you know, him just having a kind of a bit of a face of her, the one-upmanship, like, we've seen that play out so many times. And again, just the gags just didn't seem great. And then this is followed up by the laughter of love. And look, my first line in my notes is, this is shite, there's nothing funny about it. Like, to me, this song feels like it wasn't even good enough for Tony Farino. It just, like, it goes nowhere. The jokes are, like, so bad. Like, lots of Route 1 puns. And
but that
like
chorus,
that.
That chorus, thank God, it's the sound of the summer.
Also, I feel like there's an open goal here. Why not call that character Katrina instead of Virginia? Like, just to help tie it together more with other things in the APU, more than anything else.
Have you seen her?
Because then, anyone who's at the OT that has listened to Ace House is like, oh great, I know who that is. I know what's going on here. Doesn't matter if that goes over the heads of 90% of the people there, but it would just kind of make it feel a bit more intertextual, which I think is a shame. Like, who's Virginia? Never heard of her before. And it's not funny.
The only thing I can think that they wouldn't have been able to do, call it Katrina, is that it wouldn't have been believable to Oast House listeners that she died, because obviously the initial conceit is that she's died and you only find out later that she's just dead to Alan. But still, yeah, probably, yeah. You know, I still think the benefits of making it Katrina probably would have outweighed that drawback.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, moving on, because I have been giving this show a bit of a kicking so far, let's be honest. So moving on now to the interval. I thought this was a real highlight. Photos of a dog on a big screen, what's not to enjoy? So the interval, lots of pictures of Seldom. I thought this was great, so chalk that one up as a highlight. And bearing that in mind, I think we're going to take a short interval now. We'll be back with part two of this stratagem review in a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello everyone, Producer Jed here. I hope you're enjoying the show. If not, don't worry. At the end of the episode, I'll drop in my 1 minute review. Now back to the boys.
Thanks, Jed. Okay, guys, part two then. Shall I continue my loving review?
Go on.
All right, so Alan disguised as a chair. I mean, I remember listening to you guys talking about this from the live show. It's quite astounding he actually did this, because I don't know the reality of how long he would have been in that chair for. But my question is, was it worth it?
Well,
interestingly,
is it funny? I think this gag does not land on the streaming version of this, but in the crowd on the night, it was really funny. And the audience reaction reflected that. But watching it back, I think you lose something. You lose something in the gag, the fact that you're watching it on screen and not in person. I think you get more from it as a visual gag with him, with you having sat through an interval and gone through an interval, and then him coming and delivering this gag. As I think you get more from it live than you do streaming.
So do you think that's because you're aware that he's had to have been sat in this chair for 10, 15 minutes to kind of deliver that payoff?
I think so, yeah. And also you've been waiting for it as well. There's a build-up, which is the interval itself. And I don't know really what the psychology of it is, but I just remember that joke being very funny and landing with the audience in the room. But having watched it back again, wasn't as funny.
I definitely agree. I think part of it is down to the amount of time you know he must have been sat there. I also think on the streaming and live, I really enjoyed the sort of multiple misdirections of fake Alan's. You know, am I over here? Is this a pair of shoes? No, it's just a mannequin. Is this me? No, clearly not, because he's doing acrobatics. Like that bit I thought was a really nice build. But at the end of it, you're sort of like, it's really funny that he was a chair, but why was he just a chair? What was that got to do with anything? Like, they tied it back to stratagem in a very tenuous way, but it's kind of like,
yeah.
Could that have been a gag that made sense? Yeah.
Yeah. I think that you're right. Like, having been there, it was funny, but it's because the build up. And I think, frankly, you're in the room and you're kind of willing it to be good at this point. So you're like, I'll take what I can get. I'll go with
it. You've paid money for this. Yeah, you want it to be good.
It's funny.
It's that as well.
I also think it is funny the first time. I think in reality, it's a kind of one punch and done joke. It's never going to hit as hard the second time when you know, because that is really about the rug pull and the reveal. And once that's sort of been revealed, it can never be that funny, I think, on repeat watches. So I think there's a whole, you know, host of things going on there. But the reality is it's not as funny when you watch that on streaming. But yeah, it is what it is.
That's a fair point. If I didn't know that was coming, maybe I would have found it funnier. But I did, and I didn't.
Great.
Adam, I have to say, like, I think you nailed it using the word tenuous in terms of, you know, his explanation for this. I think he says, with stratagem you can be whatever you want to be. And it's just like, yeah, so they've given themselves a bit of an out in the writing here, where basically anything can happen. They can say, that's stratagem.
Yep. Or they can say, oh, you know, Alan's got such a bad grasp of his own concepts that he thinks this makes sense. But that's not good enough.
And I think that is the layer of the joke, where they say this is why it makes sense in terms of the APU, that Alan's got to an arena level show with a poorly executed idea. But it's kind of that idea eats itself when the show isn't funny enough in the first place. Like, if it was just wall-to-wall hilarious gags, I think that level of, oh, Alan doesn't know what he's doing, would work. But based on what I've seen so far, 57 minutes in, I'm going, well, this doesn't work on either level.
Well, bring us home with that last 23 minutes, which I'm sure would have changed your mind.
So yeah, we're 57 minutes in. We're returning to this idea, what is stratagem? So he's got the letters up on the screen. He's talking through start, turn up, ready, atonement, take a look in the mirror, allegory, going solo, eggs, me 2.0. Obviously, I mean, I could see this coming. We're never going to get all the way through that list. Little aside here, I thought the joke about the Elephant Man, which is common Steve Coogan territory, Elephant Man references, but interestingly, also going into Priti Patel. So the Elephant Man is ugly on the outside, beautiful on the inside, with Priti Patel it's the other way around. I just thought that was an interesting line. But yeah, I this whole thing about the conceit of what is stratagem, we're still trying to work it out. It's been like, by this point, by two-thirds of the show, that's a bit exhausting. Like, I just think, again, this life management, life coaching thing being poorly thought out and not actually having a proper purpose and conclusion, we've seen that with Lilm and just generally with Alan talking about things like Forward Solutions. So, again, that just feels a bit worn and a bit done and just not great.
I think it's a shame that they sort of lent so heavily on things don't have to make sense because it's Alan. But this this list of sort of, you know, this what's the word, acronym, I thought was probably the best thing about stratagem as a concept. The idea that there are four or five steps that are just about turning up at the beginning, and that the idea that immediately before you get to Me 2.0, you have eggs, which is never explained. But I wondered if that's a seldom influenced dietary tip. Basically, eat loads of eggs. Be more seldom. But
now that's a good tagline. Be more seldom.
Yeah, I did enjoy the list. Partly because, as you say, you're never going to get through it. A lot of it is funny because of the lack of explanation. But that doesn't extend over an hour and 20 minutes of goodwill.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's not good enough though to justify the amount of time you've invested up to that point. I kind of also thought with eggs, it's funny if it is, as you've just said, a seldom, dietary requirement, be more seldom. That is funny, but that's not explained. And so actually when I saw eggs, I was like, oh, I see what you're doing. You've kind of given up on this and you don't care. Because if you're just saying eggs, it's like, what? You're never going to have to explain that. So you can just say eggs, like... What?
That's how it reads to me. That feels like lazy writing to me. It's almost a bit like whenever they've got a gap to fill with like any kind of Alan project, it's like, he likes eggs, so he can have an egg sandwich, or he can write eggs. I think that's lazy personally. But they've used
eggs in the APU, whether it's blitzing it in the
lasagna, so many times,
blitzing it in the lasagna, or how he kind of cooks them and then throws them in the bin, and all of that stuff is really funny. Or when he leaves the voice message for his kids and he's like, let me talk to you about my favorite food, it's eggs. Yeah, that's all really, really funny. So eggs is like a really funny comedic device, with Seldom's diet. But when I saw it here, I was like, okay, well, I know that eggs is a thing in the APU, but that doesn't justify why you've used it here, because it felt to me like they were just, it basically was filler.
Yeah, it feels like at some point they've had a little, if Alan was an X, what X would he be? And the food, if Alan was a food, he'd be egg, because it's a bit queasy. It's a bit sort of, it's a little bit gross. It's very mundane. It's very everyday. If Alan was a food, he'd be egg. And I feel like that's why egg keeps coming up so much.
Okay, well, that's probably enough about eggs. Should we move on to lookalikes and Martin Brennan?
Yeah, please.
I actually thought the Afghan lookalike was very, very funny.
That definitely seems like that got a big laugh in the room as well. Actually, watching this back, but again, just a bit of visual gag because he's pulling a bit of a stupid face. Yeah. I did also laugh at the Joan Bellaby, the butcher from Derby, but particularly because he says we unwisely dated. I did think that was quite funny. I think the Martin Brennan thing is a bit like you're going for your greatest hits moments now, because obviously merely the mention of his name got like a big cheer. So I understand why they've gone for that. It's very much going, well, if we've got the 1997 I'm Alan Partridge references in, we can do Martin Brennan because that was a bit of a viral moment, so that makes sense. But does this actually bring much to the show? I don't really think it does. The chat between Alan and Martin is fine and quite broad strokes, kind of jokes about Irish families and stuff like that. Like, again, fine, but just not brilliant. The song in particular... like, when Martin starts playing, why does Alan become so overcome with emotion? Narratively, I didn't think that made any sense. It felt like the poetry into the music segment, then going back and forth between Martin, Lizzie and Alan, went on for ages and wasn't very funny. Like, oh, he's rubbish at playing a flute. Great. Bonus note, though, I think Steve Brown is in the band playing in the background, so a.k.a. Glenn Ponder. And this segment concludes with a Martin McGuinness gag. Again, not that great. Maybe if you're a little bit older, that has a bit more of a kind of cultural impact as a gag. But then I think that just means it's a bit more dated. Or I don't know. Just for me, it's like that being the punchline to Martin Brennan being in the show was not worth it. But another bonus note, though, Alan did in this section mention that he's a Burton brand ambassador. So it's good to know that he's still gone gold.
I've got to say, I think this is the point in the show where I disagree the most with you there.
Okay.
I think
I think Brennan is a highlight for a number of reasons. I think I agree it is a bit of a victory lap, but it's not so tired that they're leaning on 20-year-old material. It's something that happened a couple of years ago And I think it was funny on TV. I think this is funny still. I think they play a lot with the, you know, him not being able to use Zoom. The idea that he says he's a brand ambassador, and then Martin Brennan goes to his wife off screen. Do we know a brand ambassador? Which I thought was pretty good.
Okay, that is good actually. Yes, yeah, I'll give you that.
I think it makes sense in terms of stratagem, in that like this is the section of the show that's atonement, and he is this is a genuine attempt at atonement. So like for once, stratagem makes sense for a few minutes. I feel like this was where the audience all came together, because whether you watched it in 97 or you watched it on this time, you can see why this is funny. You can see why this, you know, relates to stratagem. You can see that it's Steve Coogan in both roles. I don't know. I thought Brennan personally was one of the highlights of the show.
Yeah, I'd agree. Show
without many highlights.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think this is where you could say I think the writing is probably its strongest as well. The sort of back and forth between how, you know, the gag that develops of him gradually inviting more and more people to dinner. The way that that develops, I think the writing is really strong there. And it's funny. And there are just some characters that I think Alan bounces off very well, and there's lots of comedic potential. And Martin Brennan is one of them. And yeah, I really enjoyed... So I've rewatched Stratagem streaming twice and live once, so three times now, and every time I've enjoyed the Martin Brennan bit.
I wonder as well, you know, I think a lot of the strength of this show as it continues is about the kind of like the goodwill. So I wonder as well, because you'd been in the room and saw this live and it worked really well in the room, so whether you're inherently a bit more open to it by this point, whereas I've been sitting at home essentially not really enjoying any of this show at this point to a large extent, so I'm almost kind of running out of goodwill. However, to be fair, to be slightly less harsh, I think you're right that the first bit, the back and forth with him on Zoom with the family members and stuff, I think yes, that works, like the rapport between the two characters, and also on a technical point of view that works really well, unlike the phone calls of Lynn, which feel like we talked about, feel a bit stilted and a bit delayed. Like, I think they have nailed it by that point, and actually...
That's interesting, though, isn't it? Because that's arguably a more difficult section, the Martin Brennan bit, than what they did with Lynn, because there's less dialogue, it's less back and forth.
Yeah.
This is the bit that should have been worse, like, from a technical point of view, because it was arguably more complicated, whereas the Lynn one felt a lot more simple in comparison.
Do you think it's as simple as this is Steve Coogan, like, on both ends of the line? Like, he recorded the Brennan part, obviously, so he's interacting with himself, so his sense of timing works better than when he's playing off Felicity.
Yeah, maybe.
I think there's also a point, because this setup is through Zoom, so actually, if anything was a little bit off time, that works within the world of Zoom anyway.
Yeah.
So you're going to be perhaps a bit less critical of how the back and forth goes. But yeah, to be fairer, that bit was good. I think it's the music bit that lost me on this, because I felt like that went on for ages and just wasn't actually funny. Possibly my favourite gag of the whole show came up after this, probably just because I was not expecting it. So Alan then talks about the last time he cried on stage was when he drilled through a thumbnail, and stemming the blood flow, he looked like he was doing a Black Power salute, which made people uncomfortable. So he flattened his palm to a Nazi salute. That was fine. It was at an event being hosted by Kirsty Allsop. I genuinely laughed out loud at that because I just wasn't expecting it.
And also, I thought that was great. There's a lot of goodwill from us on in relation to Kirsty Allsop based gags, because they're all very, very funny in Osthaus. So they're fresh in the mind. Any gags or barbs at Allsop, I think, are going to land quite well with us.
Yeah, but I think it's just something like that. Like, it just kind of came out of nowhere, and I don't think there are enough gags in this show that you can't see signposted. That's potentially a big part of it. So, you know, I was talking about the fake vagina, nearly missed my flight. You can see where that was going, but it worked well enough. Something like a Nazi salute and a Kirsty Allsop event, wouldn't have been expecting that in the script at all. So yeah, that was probably the bit that I enjoyed the most, and it made me laugh out loud due to not expecting it. But yeah, from the good to the bad, we then get a character that I've named Drunk Nina, who's literally screaming with excitement to come up on stage. But then why is she that excited? Because as they talk, it's kind of revealed that she's not really his audience. She doesn't know who he is, so why would she be that excited? I just don't get what they're trying to do with that. Although I did like,
is she not meant to be a sort of a type, you know, that like is out?
Oh, she's out for a big night out.
On a hen do, you know, like has just had a load of Bacardi breezes and basically is excited about being up on stage in general.
Yes, but again, there are surely better ways they could have done this. Yes, you're totally right. She's supposed to be a type who is not Alan's type of audience. But I just think it just doesn't work. I mean, I like the bit when she calls them nosal hairs and tells them he needs to get a strimmer. I thought that was good. God knows, we're about an hour, 15 minutes in. She's still asking him what stratagem is. And I think we all are by this point. But, you know, this is a really clunky plot device to get the reveal that Virginia isn't actually dead, despite the song saying that she was. Now, this just doesn't make sense. Why would this Nina character have determined that from this song? So a character who is supposed to be essentially drunk out of her mind, doesn't know who Alan is, why would she be paying that much attention to this and going, oh, actually, she's still alive and this is all about rekindling that? So clunky. There must have been so many other ways they could have done this, and it felt like they're really trying to shoehorn this quite abrupt turn in the narrative.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's a wider discussion, which we don't probably have time for, is like the narrative they try and shoehorn in here as well. Do they even need that? Like, I think if the stratagem idea had been developed into something that was a bit different, I don't think they'd have needed to try and create this narrative thread about Alan's kind of unrequited love, because this only really becomes a thing now, and we're about 10 minutes out from the end of the show. I just think it seems really messy to me.
Yeah, and I think I certainly felt watching it live and watching it on Amazon that kind of whether they should, they shouldn't, and is the character good or not, I'm kind of clock watching at this point as well, because I'm not massively invested. But I would agree, this character is another odd creative choice where it's a strange decision, because yeah, she might be out on a hen do, or maybe she's with a partner, but realistically, that character doesn't really have any kind of a role as it's played on stage to kind of really,
she's literally there to make the plot go from A to B.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that the point of the character is played against the backdrop of a really, really annoying person, an annoying character. And I think this is one of the things where obviously the character is annoying Alan as well, but I think the character is also annoying the audience, because it's not funny, it's just annoying. So what you've now got is 20,000 people or 15,000 people who are just annoyed going into the fun of the final part of your show.
The only bit I kind of liked was the idea of some real life tension, that there's the possibility that somebody sees this show on the first date of the tour, call someone that's going to see it a few days later and says, there's going to be a bit where they ask for someone to come up from the audience and they've got a plan. So if you hear this line, run up first and see what happens.
Oh, so actually, there's a question for you then. Because obviously in the streaming, I was going to call it DVD, in the streaming version of this, that transition happens pretty quickly about get someone up on stage. She starts shrieking and is walking down the aisle like immediately in the way this is edited. Did they play
that's
that a bit?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh no.
That's exactly how it happened live. Okay. And I think for the reason I've just said, if they left a hanging pause, some idiot would have gone up first and ruined the whole show. So immediately.
Yeah.
And I did like the idea that represents a bit of risk that you could only have live, but you know, in reality, they've got a spotlight on her. Anyone else that stands up is not going to get.
And I think
first.
That probably explains as well, because I found that she's shrieking from the moment she stands up, right? I found that a little bit disconcerting for like half a second the first time I watched this, because essentially Alan's still like mid sentence and somebody starts screaming in the audience. I was like, what the. Like, it becomes apparent what's happening within about a second, but you've got that split-second moment where it's like, what's going on? So, yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think, right, they have to make that moment happen almost simultaneously to get in front of just an actual member of the public.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, then, shall we move on to the closing medley and then perhaps a little conclusion?
I'm actually quite happy that it was too expensive to get all these songs for the medley, because the medley was not good. The medley was not good, so it was actually I was almost dreading having to sit through that medley again, and the fact that I didn't have to was actually a massive bonus.
I've got a lot of questions about the medley and why you don't get it on the streaming, because I mean, obviously, they say it's rights issues, they couldn't afford it. I guess that probably is the truth. But I thought, if that's the case, if you're writing an arena show and you can have a medley that isn't on a theme particularly, like you could pick any songs to be in that medley, why wouldn't you choose ones that you know you can clear for the streaming as well? Like, why would you risk having this whole bit cut out? So are there genuine rights issues? Was it just added as a bit of an extra joke, you know, this, so he can do this funny voiceover about, you know, that they all have to be having a laugh, have to be? Or was it deliberately to give people who went live something that nobody else gets, so that you do feel a bit special for your 60 quid? I just wasn't completely convinced that they couldn't have got the rights if they wanted to. It was almost like they chose not to.
Yeah, I think we don't know. It's got to be one of the things that it's one of those three options that you've just kind of given. And I would actually genuinely be curious to kind of understand. My gut says that it can't be a musical rights issues, because it's being performed, as opposed to the Sean Paul track, for example. I could imagine would have cost, you know, there's a buyout or whatever it was, and actually.
But I think it's different because they're releasing it as a commercial product. I think that changes the usage. So
yeah, I'm
like it's possible that the songwriters could not grant permission for it, or demand such a fee, they go, we can't afford to use this, so we'll just cut it out. I do find that surprising. You've got to think, you know, in the past we've had Kate Bush medleys, Queen medleys. Why would people like Queen and Kate Bush be approving their use of music and not the estate of George Michael for a song?
Yeah,
that's the thing. I
when
can't
you're backed by Amazon squelchy cash as well.
yeah.
I wonder if they genuinely thought it was better for the pace of the show on streaming to not have a medley and to have this voiceover with some jokes in it. Like, there's a bit where he blames the artist directly, including George Michael. So, you know, like, he's blaming a dead man for not licensing his song. And the bit where he's like, yeah, you know, he names all of the people who've refused him rights, and he says they all of whom have to be having a laugh, have to be. Look at what Netflix has done for Kate Bush. That could have been you. Like, you know, those jokes are okay, but it doesn't feel like it's worth losing a medley to put them in.
Well, I mean, I haven't seen the medley, though. It depends how bad the medley was.
I mean, it was fine. You know, it was all. I mean, I suppose they were backed slightly into a corner in that for an arena show, all the songs in the medley have to be like household name hits, don't they?
Well, look, if you work in music licensing and you know the truth behind this, please get in touch and let us know. Guy, I think that is. Genuinely quite interesting. There are a few options that it could be. There isn't just a yes or a no to that. So yeah, that would be really interesting to know what the reality is there. I think you might appreciate then my first note on this closing medley, when Alan says I fear the medley of 80s power ballads coming on, my first note was please God no.
Yeah. And also once the medley is done and it cuts to the back and forth with the woman he ends up lifting up, there's a bit where he goes, do you want me to finish the song? And there's not much of a reaction from the audience. No.
Yeah, but you see that, and that bit, I really like that bit when you get this bit at the end where you basically get like some glimpses of like angry Alan, because he said, oh, that's about a third of you, and that's enough to win a general election. The way he delivers that feels a bit off the cuff, and it suddenly, that felt like a glimpse of the Alan we saw at the end of this time. And it's just like, I think that could have had so much more legs for this show. The Alan that was, you know, hopping mad in this time, that Alan kind of having a bit more of an anger around him, and maybe those kind of character traits of like Alan on the edge, I think could have made this a much more exciting and dynamic show instead of Alan just doing like a load of random variety show stuff. But again, it's, you know, whether it is that thing of the Gibbons and Steve just saying anything the fans can think of, we're not going to do, because I think a lot of people were kind of speculating after the end of this time series two that Alan's stratagem show would be doing something that almost puts him into borderline right-wing GB News soapbox type territory. And I think that could have worked, but, you know, I'm not the writer. I'm just a viewer. Because, you know, also things like, I don't know what kilograms are. You know, you start to get some little kind of glimmers of Alan having a slightly different energy to what we've seen throughout the other show. And so this, just to bring us, this kind of brings us actually back to what we were talking about at the start. Like, the thing about, he talks about PR, so proportional representation, coalitions and mandates and Nick Clegg. I mean, him mentioning Nick Clegg did make me laugh, but that's just because it's Nick Clegg, I think. But yeah, I just think, you know, there's a way that it could have been more Alan focusing on those sort of topics to bring it, to make it feel more current, make it feel more now, instead of gags about Intel Pentiums and things that look like iPod adverts. And it would have felt more consistent with the Gibbons era of writing as well. So I'm astonished that the show wasn't something more like that, instead of what you've essentially got is an Alan Partridge show from 1999.
Very fair. Just to move on from the finale, just to briefly touch on the credits. Did everybody notice that we have a Gabitas in the credits?
Yeah, that's a nice little Easter egg, isn't it?
That's good.
Yeah, he's credited as a driver, isn't he, I think?
Crash, bang, wallet, what a driver.
I wonder if we'll ever get to the bottom of the Gabitas mystery. Okay, so look, I'll give you guys my kind of concluding thoughts on this, although I think it's pretty clear what I thought of the whole thing, really. Yeah, like I say, the whole show feels really dated, like it's some kind of light entertainment variety show from the 90s. And in the same vein that watching those sort of older comedies now, they feel quite dated and bad and wrong. You know, like when we did The Man Who Thinks He's It from 1998, I loved that at the time. I still kind of love it now because of the familiarity, but arguably you watch that in a 2022, 2023 lens and you go, this hasn't dated very well. And I think this, the whole feel of this feels quite of a time and not this time, no pun intended. I think it's a real shame that there's no cohesion or consistency with the wider APU, really. Like I say, I'm disappointed it didn't make much more of where we left the character at the end of this time, or even bringing more cohesion in with Oathouse. Like I say, the love interest could have been Katrina, just some kind of niche Easter eggy type things like that. The time travel segment I hated, you know, and it just didn't really fit with anything that we've seen from Alan in the past. Like other bits in the show, even if they weren't great, you know, Lynn popping up, Alan doing medleys, like we've seen Alan do medleys, like everything else in the show still had some kind of Alan tangibility. The time travel segment for me just totally lost me. And I also feel it's a shame that I felt like this show really lacked kind of the delicate writing and the attention to detail that we've been able to enjoy from Steve and the Gibbons brothers for the last decade plus. Like this felt lazy and rushed, and I think ultimately I feel like they were overstretched trying to do an arena-sized show. It's worth noting as well, this is the first time Steve Coogan's done a live show that's all Alan. It's only been like 25, 30 minutes of Alan in previous shows. And as much as I understand there's an argument about making it broader to appeal to an arena-sized crowd, ultimately I'd say just because it's broad doesn't mean it has to be shit. So in summary, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed. For me, and this is the bombshell, I think this is the worst piece of Partridge we've ever had.
Wow. I think that's all very valid. One thing that your summaries reminded me of is that probably with the exception of Alpha Papa, this is the longest stretch of continuous Partridge we've ever had as well.
Yeah.
I suppose you could count the audiobooks, although they broke it up into chapters. Yeah. But yeah, you know, it's Alan being Alan for the longest time. So Tom, Nick, we obviously saw this live at the O2. Now that you've seen it again on streaming, has your opinion of it gone up, gone down? Have you noticed anything you thought was particularly good that you missed it live, or the other way around?
I'm happy to go first. I think overall my feeling would be that it's probably similar. But I didn't love it when we watched it live, and maybe I was somewhat guilty of giving, you know, sort of willing it to be good because you paid a lot of money and you are in the arena watching it live. And I think that that kind of adds a little bit of weight to some of the gags, because you want it to be funny and you're sort of feeding off the energy in the room. Whereas when you're sat at home in your living room on your own watching it and there's no one around you and you're just concentrating on this, I found it a challenge to watch without opening Twitter or, you know, checking the time to see surely 50 minutes has gone. No, it's been on for about 20 minutes. I think for me, I rewatch so and re-listen to so much Alan. So whether it's the audiobooks, whether it's this time, like the Gibbons era writing, I will rewatch time and time and time again, and I still rewatch it and still listen to the books frequently. I will never be going back to this for the foreseeable, basically. So that is the only kind of measure that I can use to sort of prove that I really didn't get on with it. And I think something that you mentioned, Adam, but I think ultimately we all agree with, is it doesn't work. He's done this now in three or four different live shows. None of them have been good as far as I could see, or they're certainly the weakest. I think it's an interesting question. Is this the worst Partridge, and one I'd maybe need to ponder? But without a doubt, it's certainly one of the weakest pieces of Partridge, which I'm sad to say, but it's the truth.
Yeah, I think I would broadly agree with what Nick's saying. I think, again, rewatching it, and my memories from seeing it live were that the opening was strong. I thought this was going to be good. And then by the end of it, when I came out, I was like, was that actually good? I'm not sure a lot of that was actually very good. But I still stand by that I really do like the opening sort of 20 minutes or so of it. I completely agree with Nick. I think there's no value in going back to this whatsoever. I might watch maybe the Martin Brennan section if someone clips it and puts it on YouTube, because I just like Alan and Martin interacting with that character, but I wouldn't like purposefully go to Amazon Prime, open the show, start playing it, fast forward to that section. I just wouldn't bother, but I might rewatch it on YouTube. But yeah, it's one of those things where you are in a venue with other people, and there's the kind of the communal experience of watching something with other people that I think does elevate it slightly from watching at home on the sofa. I actually, this is a good example. I recently rewatched Everything Everywhere All at Once, and I watched that in a packed cinema, and it was an amazing viewing experience watching that in a packed cinema. Watching it at home on the telly, I think it lost a bit of that impact that it had watching it as a group experience. And I think you maybe do get a little, like maybe 10%, 15% more from watching something in a room with other people that you can't replicate at home. So, I think my view of this would probably go down slightly if we were looking at stars. I think it was maybe on the night I felt it was a 7, and now it's probably maybe a 5 or a 6.
Yeah, very fair. I think my thing with the kind of collective experience is that everyone in that room, it was in the interests of everybody in that room, from Steve to the bar staff to the people in the seats, for it to be good. So why wasn't it good? It's a double-edged sword seeing it with so many other people, because yeah, I think it can give you a bit of a false sense of willing it into being decent. But also, I think if all of those people and their collective goodwill, if you can still tell it's not great, then it really isn't that great, is it? One thing I noticed from watching on streaming that I will say in its defense is that there were more jokes that worked than I remember from seeing it live, but I think they were very kind of packed into little dense spots throughout a very long show. Just so unevenly paced. I feel like the crowd seemed really flat. The subtle bits are too subtle. The broad bits are too broad. As we've said, the musical review style of it feels quite dated, even with the caveat that it comes from Alan's mind. I think a lot of stratagem might have worked in another context, but in an arena show, in the first set of arena shows for, 12 years, I think, the stakes are too high for it to fall flat. And I don't think that you can use Alan putting together a chaotic show as an excuse for how flat a lot of stratagems ended up being.
Okay, so look, just to make sure we've covered this fully, I think it's only fair we give our producer, Jed Shepherd, his opportunity for a 1 minute review of Stratagem, just to make sure we've got everybody's views on record. So Jed, over to you.
Hello again, it's producer Jed here, back with my 1 minute reviews. Right, I know a thing or two about horror, so I was suitably prepared for Stratagem. I think it's safe to say that I'm with the boys on this. This is the worst Partridge ever. It's worse than Alpha Papa, and that's the very bottom of the barrel. This is on par with the infamous Monkey Tennis at Comic-Con event. It feels incredibly dated, forced, and unfortunately, wildly unfunny. I don't think we can keep making excuses for the jokes and references being outdated just because Alan's outdated himself. That's been done to the point of exhaustion. This is just a misfire, thankfully a rare one. I can truthfully say that this is the first time I didn't enjoy Alan output. That's pretty good going for 30 years. I'm giving Stratagem 1 seldom out of 10. See you next time on Jed's 1 Minute Reviews.
Thanks, Jed. We completely agree, or don't, depending on what you just said just then. All right, so look, I think I was kind of interested to wrap this up with 2 points. So, you know, we haven't gone out on socials to ask for your thoughts on this Stratagem on Amazon Prime, because we've not had the time to put that question out there. But I think broadly, the feedback we'd had about the live show when you guys covered that on an episode previously felt like broad agreement, in essence. A lot of people saying they were willing it to be good, but in reality it actually wasn't that good. And I think it's very interesting. I think this speaks for a lot that we've got that kind of the evidence there. And also currently on Amazon, this has 36% of the reviews are 1 star. So I think, you know, this isn't just the diehard Partridge fans that are finding this somewhat lacking. So for me to wrap this up, I wanted to put a question out there to the listeners. Does anybody disagree with us that this is bad? If you liked it, please try and convince us that we're wrong. Tell us what was good about it. Tell us what your favourite bits were. And yeah, essentially, can you change our minds?
I think we'd like to be wrong, but tragically, we're not. We're right. But please do get in touch with your opinions. We'd love to know what you thought of Stratagem, whether you were in the room watching it live or that you've picked it up on Amazon Prime. It's thepartridgepod@gmail.com, facebook.com/thepartridgepod, Twitter @thepartridgepod, Instagram @monkeytennispod, or you can leave a voice note on the Monkey Tennis hotline, 07923 600 017. Don't have an opinion other than that we're great and you enjoy listening to us? Then throw us a couple of quid at ko-fi.com/monkeytennis, and that'll be much appreciated and help us to bring you more Partridge analysis in the future. This is very much a one-off episode, not the start of a new series. You'll have noticed we've covered the vast majority of Partridge content that's out there, but there are rumblings of new Partridge on the horizon, so no doubt we'll be back to cover that in due course. But for now, from all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast, thanks and goodbye.
I mean, it was just crazy bad.
I'm hopping mad, and I want something in the middle.
Aha! Yupsalutely, yupsalutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Little piss, my foot on the spank.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical, awesome, mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Edmonds is a total wazzup of a guy.
Yes, 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 and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that? Like, this is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net. Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.